Thank you very much for the invitation, Yuri and Antoine. Basically, I was invited, and the way I structured the talk was as an introduction to hopefully a very exciting talk that I was very interested in hearing myself. So I really start quite low level, so please don't be too frightened when we get going here. So I don't know how this is supposed to work yet. So I just wanted to acknowledge there's an absolute ton of people who have contributed work that I'm going to be presenting little snippets of here, most of which are either from PMH. There's a few from other institutions that are represented in and around our community quite often, as well as back from Washington University, where I did quite a bit of my training. So I do have to note that some of the work was funded by the NIH and the NCIC, but I really have no conflict of interest presented with any of the technologies in this talk thus far. So just to give you an idea of the scope of the problem that we're dealing with cancer, in 2008 alone, it was estimated that there's almost 150,000 people that will be diagnosed, and that's roughly 3,200 people per week being diagnosed with cancer here in Canada. And unfortunately, there's still about 75,000 that are dying each year directly as a result of cancer. And that, again, correlates to about 1,500 per week. So, you know, this is, what, maybe 100-person room, 15 times this room every week is extinguished, basically. So the current incidence rates suggest that almost half of everyone in this room, well, 40% for the women in the room, will develop cancer at some point in their lifetime. And these aren't all fatal cancers, but these are cancers, and they're important to keep in mind. But the thing that I focus on here is that in Ontario, more than 25,000 people died just this last year, and of them, 7,000 alone died from just lung cancer. And that's actually the area that one of the areas I focus on, the other being head and neck cancer. And I'm going to try to structure the talk around this number, basically, because this is the number what we'd like to reduce as much as possible over the next 5, 10, 15 years. This is just a little reinforcement. The types of cancer that are out here, you know, lung tops the list in deaths for both men and women, but it isn't the most common cancer. For women, it's breast cancer, and for men, it's prostate cancer. But when you add all the patients with lung cancer, both men and women, up, they become the most prominent group. So it's the most deadly cancer in Canada, and it's the most likely, especially for people who smoke. So, word of warning. You all know what medical imaging probably is, but I felt obliged to Wikipedia it just for my own amusement. But it refers to the techniques and processes used to create images of the human body for clinical purposes. And those purposes usually involve either revealing, diagnosing, or examining cancer or disease, and then, you know, studying normal anatomy and or physiology. So this is kind of a structural thing. What we have to remember is that tumors are effectively composed of small cells and begin as very, very small clusters of cells that we really can't detect with most imaging modalities until they become thresholds, so above a centimeter in cubic dimensions. There are some imaging modalities that can resolve tumors much smaller than that, but you have to know where you're looking in the first place. So things like MR, CT, SPECT, PET all require, you know, macroscopic disease to detect. So it can take quite a while for things to come up on the radar. And by that time, we're well along this process that leads to eventually, in some patients, death. So these are kind of a overview slide looking back from the very first radiographic information we had back in the 1900s all the way up to the more modern things that I think some of the diffusion data Ross may be mentioning at some point during his talk. But we have a number of different imaging modalities that have been developed and explored over the last 100 years, effectively. I'm going to mention a few. PET, I'm not really going to focus too much on MRI, but PET-CT and CT itself, as well as multi-slice CT, are all very, very commonly utilized in medical and day-to-day clinic. And they're used by pretty much every oncologic specialty to direct therapy, to monitor response, and to keep an eye on when patients are developing a problem. So we kind of generally group imaging in terms of a couple types of classifications. The energy used, or the mechanism by which it's you develop the image, i.e. x-rays or positrons, not photos, probably photons, actually. But you could actually use photos as well, so visual imaging, or sound, like ultrasound. And the spatial resolution actually is important for some people. So whether or not you want to be macroscopic, i.e. large tumors that you can detect that are size of the football, or even microscopic disease that you can detect by looking with a small camera into someone's lung to see a very small change in the surface of the inside of the bronchus. the type of information that you acquire from imaging is also quite relevant. So most of the imaging that we developed back on this slide here, starting back, was primarily anatomic. It basically said, you know, here's a thing we can see, not what the thing did in most cases. In some areas, ultrasound and then PET and MRI, we began to get some functional information out, but it really has become the most, probably the last 5 or 10 years, where we really can get some functional imaging or molecular imaging out of the actual cellular processes that drive and cause cancer progression. So the other things that people always look at, especially in systems where resources are limited, are the time involved in acquiring the image and the cost. And so this is kind of a big table that breaks down some of the imaging modalities by some of those features. And I'm going to kind of ignore the bottom half of this and ultrasound, because I really want to focus on the things that we can easily get our hands on, the big 3D data sets that we can use to potentially derive additional information in combination with either each other or with in combination with a directed therapy like radiation. So the one that we all probably are most familiar with is CT. And CT is a very simple imaging modality in the sense that it's really just projected X-rays through a target that you then do from multiple angles and back project to generate a pretty picture of a cross-sectional view of someone's body. In this case, this is a person, thorax, with a lung, a heart, spinal cord. I look at these every day. So this is critical for what I do with lung cancer and with treatment of lung cancer. The other things that you can do with similar sorts of approaches are to put a source of radiation inside the patient. And we often do that by doing an injection of either a radio tracer, such as technetium, or in some cases a positron emitter, where we can inject it. It'll go through the body, directed at some target, whatever that target may be, and then emit either a photon, which we can detect, or emit a positron, which decays and then emits two opposing photons, which can then be detected by simultaneous impingement on detectors. And we can generate from that the same back-projected data to show where that signal came from within the body. And for SPECT, we use that oftentimes with specific labels, or to look at things like breathing inhaled gases that have radiographic properties, or injections into the blood that we can use to kind of map out where we're seeing ventilation and perfusion in the lungs, so we can detect how people are breathing and how they're not breathing. Similarly, with PET, we can inject a tracer such as glucose that has a fluorine label on it that can glow, quote unquote, at the place where the tumor is. And we can then pick out differentially areas of tumor over areas of not tumor in the lung. And we can quickly pick out and identify areas that we're concerned about. MRI is a very complex math-filled physics mess that I'm not going to be able to explain, but I know that it makes pretty pictures. The short answer is that you can align protons within the body and then stimulate them to emit a radio frequency pulse that you can detect. There's way more math there than I'm capable of explaining, but the short and the long of it is it provides very good soft tissue contrast between things that have water in them, things that have fat in them. So basically soft tissues in and around the spine, in and around muscle, that you couldn't resolve easily with CT, like in this area, are much more clear on MR. So that's kind of the general scope of the types of imaging that I see every day. And then really, these imaging methods become critical for cancer therapy in a number of directions. Really, diagnosis, I'm not going to focus on that because by the time people get to me, they've usually been diagnosed. We know that they have a problem and we're trying to fix it. So I'm going to leave that one out. And I'm going to focus primarily on the therapy. And the therapy that I deliver is radiation. And we'll go into that in more detail. But effectively, radiation is just X-rays that we use to treat therapeutically by giving a heck of a lot more than you need to take a picture with. And we then monitor how we're doing with our therapy. And over the long term, we can assess the response. So radiation therapy is, again, a localized treatment. We use ionizing radiation. And we direct it pretty focally at a cancer target within the body. Almost half, probably more so, of every single cancer patient, and that's that big number I gave you, the 80,000 or something, will receive radiotherapy at some point in their treatment, either up front to cure them or down the line if they develop a cancer that cannot be cured but still needs to be treated to reduce symptoms. So we now can use computerized methods and robotic systems to target the radiation very precisely, and that targeting requires very, very high accuracy and can allow us to avoid normal tissues, things that aren't cancer, So your normal lung, for instance, is something that I don't really want to treat with radiation if I can avoid it. Whereas I would like to give a very high dose of radiation to the target, that being the tumor, to make it go away. So the local control or removal of a tumor at a given location is a critical element of our entire specialty. So these methods, all of this, the hard computational stuff, requires accurate targeting and delineation, which we use based on the imaging. And really, we use primarily geographic. That's the CTE, the MR, that shows us the structures that we're interested in. Or functional, that being the glowing stuff, or the PET signal that shows us where something's active or where something has uptake of a type of tracer that we're interested in. So this is going to step a little bit forward. So let's pretend that we already have identified a target, so a lung cancer, for instance, that we want to treat. That's this red thing. It's bad. We don't want it. That's what we call in radiation oncology the gross target volume. Effectively, or gross tumor volume in some people's minds. The problem is that imaging, in general, has an error, a fuzziness about it, in that I can't tell, looking at the CT slice, exactly where the edge of that tumor is under the microscope. So if I were to take the exact same slice, look at it under the microscope, there may be one cell on the other side of that pixel line as compared to normally. And so we have this clinical target volume, which includes a portion of that uncertainty in the imaging, as well as a concern that there may be one tumor cell that wasn't actually in the big mass, but was already starting to creep somewhere else. And so I will include areas that I'm concerned may have tumor, but I don't know for sure based on the imaging or the data I have available. And then there's another margin we put on thing, which is the planning target volume, which is to say we know that when we deliver treatment, we're not perfect about it. We have uncertainties in the way we import the images. We have uncertainties about the way the images are processed. We have uncertainties in the way the treatment actually gets delivered, all of which requires us to kind of hedge our bets a little bit so we don't miss this target. And all of these expansions are generated as a part of the planning process to account for those uncertainties. And so they're really quite important. So when you have this tumor and you have these margins, you can then generate, via the complex computed stuff I mentioned, the dose distribution. I'm not actually going to focus primarily on IMRT or the computerized treatment planning systems that we use to generate those doses. I think that's probably a topic for maybe a different seminar. But the short and long answer is we can actually generate doses that conform very tightly to whatever volumes we delineate now. And that has advantages and disadvantages, as I probably can lead you to. The advantages being we can avoid tissue we don't want to hit. The disadvantage being if we don't know what we're shooting at, we miss. So the delineation and the imaging that forms the basis for that delineation becomes even more critical. So this is an example of a lung patient with lung cancer, and the radiation oncologist who treated this patient drew this red circle. And that red circle was effectively what they thought was the tumor. Could anybody, I mean, obviously none of you probably have delineated lung cancer before, but I can't tell the difference between this area and this area. There's a line there that's very difficult to appreciate. And it may not be appreciable on CT, for instance. But this is what they thought, but they thought that because of this. So this is actually a PET image. So a tracer that was given to this patient, that was put in their vein, went through their system, accumulated in the tumor, and gave off a radiographic signal that could be detected, and lent additional information that was critical to helping the radiation oncologist figure out exactly what part of that blob was something they wanted to treat with radiation. So this is probably the most fundamental example that I can think of how additional information makes my job easier and simultaneously harder, because I have to figure out how to use this information and to get it into the right place to use it. So another example is MRI. So you can see on CT, you can kind of see where this tumor is abutting the spinal cord and creeping in, but on MRI, it's much more apparent. And I can draw a much better line around that MRI image than I could on the CT image. The trick to this is that I'm planning my radiation on the CT image because that's what I can use to calculate the radiation dose that's going to be delivered. I can't calculate the dose here, so this information has to be transposed in some fashion onto that CT so I can use it. And there's this whole issue of medical image registration, which fortunately we have an expert sitting in the front row that will hopefully teach us exactly how to do that. But this is the reason why I need it. So there's another example here is that sometimes things look the same on CT. So this is, unfortunately, this didn't project very well. I apologize. There's a lump right here that the arrow's pointing to, that's a lymph node, and it's a little bit enlarged. There's another similar lump underneath the airway here that's also enlarged. One has that PET signal I talked about, and one doesn't. And as such, when they went in and poked each one with a needle, they were able to show, even without going in and taking tissue, that they could tell which one had cancer in it. And that's, again, very relevant to what we're trying to do in that delineating a target. So this multiple modality imaging is really important. So I'm going to basically kind of leave that there, but target delineation benefits from multiple inputs. We select the imaging modality we're going to use for that based on the goal of that specific study. So if we need more anatomic information to pick out where the tumor is relative to the spine, we can use MRI, for instance. If we don't know kind of what's in it or what's going on, we can use some functional imaging, either SPECT, PET, or potentially in the future we have additional tracers that are coming online that can focus on elements that may make a tumor more resistant to treatment or may actually make a tumor more sensitive to treatment. So things like lack of oxygen or lack of blood flow are things we could potentially image and then use that image, that imaging data, to direct our therapy. So as I mentioned a couple times, we need to be able to register the data from each of these different sources back to the planning reference frame, that being the CTE scan that we're generating our radiation dose on, so we can hopefully use all that information. And it's relatively computationally expensive and time expensive for me to go in there and try to manually line up these images. There are some algorithms that are in some of the more advanced planning systems now. Almost everything has something to do with rigid registration, but things like deformable registration, dealing with multiple data sets simultaneously, or data sets that have very, very sparse information anatomically and registering those with anatomic images can be very challenging. So hopefully we'll have some more on that in a little while. So I'm going to shift away from the multimodality part and focus on a few other issues that have to do with hitting the target. So you've seen this before, and we've all gone through the first class now, so we're going to skip to the graduate level. So what happens when your target does this? So when you're breathing, which we hope all of our patients are going to do while we're treating them, the target is not stationary for lung cancer. It's moving, and if our radiation dose is directed at a quote-unquote stable position of the tumor, that's not going to go well for us because we're going to be missing the tumor some percentage of the time unless we account for that in some way. So there's going to be a couple advances that I'm going to focus on that, you know, we use on a day-to-day basis in clinic now, including motion-corrected CT and cone beam CT in the treatment unit, as well as, you know, additional ways to use that data down the line to assess treatment response. So I'm going to focus first of all on the kind of availability of the 4D CT, which is motion-corrected CT effectively. So this is a CT scan of someone's chest when they're breathing, and a CT scan works by kind of taking segmental slices through the patient. You know, stops here, takes a picture, moves down, stops here, take a picture. There's newer versions that do it kind of continuous helical acquisition, but for a long time, these sorts of artifacts were very common because during this slice, the patient was breathing out, and during this next slice, it happened the patient breathed in. And so they caught a gap, basically, in the data. And unfortunately, that can happen in a tumor, so you can underestimate the tumor size. You could misguesstimate where the tumor is going to be. There's lots of issues related to motion and, you know, inadequate sampling of a data set. So this is an example of a tumor that's moving during breathing, corrected for a 4D scan. And I'm going to skip, this is skipping ahead a little ways, but this is actually taken while someone's being treated or is about to be treated. So what we need to do to deal with the motion and motion artifacts themselves are either figure out ways to stop the tumor from moving. I don't prefer those because I get scared when my patients stop breathing or they stop moving. Fast scanning, so scanning so rapidly that the breathing is relatively meaningless from the standpoint of that single snapshot. Or patient preparation, so having the patient kind of do a little bit of both, holding their breath or really, really slowly breathing. So what we prefer to do probably is to leave the patient alone and just correct the imaging either by retrospective methods or by snapping the imaging on and off at the same time, so gating the image or tracking to allow correction of the entire process dynamically. Again, I'm going to focus on just one small portion of this, that being the retrospective sorting of the data, and I'm going to steal some slides from one of my colleagues who I think gives one of the best presentations on 4D CT, and this is an example of kind of a periodic motion that we wanted to figure out. It's the croc clock. So you can see it moves, and if you snapped a continuous picture of that croc, he's going to be a blurred little mess. You can't really pick out a lot of detail. You don't know where he is. he's having difficulty. But if you focus on this, you can see even here there's a signal that you could resolve. He's waving. So but you can pull that signal out and say the number of green pixels in that little area I can track and pull out a signal that says this is the periodic nature of the motion that we're trying to fix. And you could graph it on a phase plot where amplitude is along this axis and, you know, the directionality or phase is around. And then you could pick out certain bits of the data to look at. And if you look at how high or how far up his hand is, you can pull out the amplitude. And if you pull out kind of which part of the arc he's in, you can pull out the phase. So these are types of ways you could sort data if you were able to acquire, like the croc clock, multiple pictures of something as it was going by. So if you grabbed all the things where the croc was right near the beginning of his little cycle, he'd be a little bit blurred, but not too much. As all the pictures going up and down, you can see that you get both sides. And then further out, he's back to that position. The difficulty here is that in this case and this case, you're getting both him going out and him coming back. And you can't really tell the difference. So there's something like if there's hysteresis, like if he moves out differently than he comes back in a circle, that kind of messes up your reconstruction a little bit. But if you do phase, you have a different but similarly problematic issue. You know, during the kind of each peak of the pendulum, he's relatively stationary, so you get a pretty good picture there. But while he's moving through the middle, he blurs. So stable, blurring as he accelerates through the midpoint of the pendulum. Not so much here, and it's logical. It makes sense. So these sorts of tricks have been used to reconstruct or to bin the data that we get from something called 4DCT, which is basically oversampling the data that we're acquiring from a normal CT scan to the point where we can look for these sorts of patterns and try to resolve those sorts of issues. So what we'll do is just put a simple marker on someone's abdomen so when they're breathing, it goes up and down, which is kind of like the hand waving. Gives us a little signal, which we see here, and then we can actually tag all the images we acquire at any point along that data set to then do these sorts of binning exercises to figure out if we can resolve the motion within the data set. And we just use a routine CT scanner. We just add a little bit of extra junk on top to give the signal. So this is the kind of 3D data lung volume that we would normally collect. And usually we focus on a little segment of 16 slices because that's what we used to have where I did 4DCT the first time. They now have 64 slice and 280, and I'm sure they'll have a billion slice scanner soon that will scan your entire body every two microseconds. But the CINI acquisition of this 16 slice segment basically is going to be a function of where they are breathing. So here, they're mostly inhaled, which you tag along with the external breathing surrogate that's going up and down in their abdomen. If you do that for every single image, you can then go back through and resort not by when you acquired the images, but rather by where they were in the breathing cycle, and get a relatively pretty picture of them breathing in and out, which is what I showed you that very first time, where the patient was breathing just before treatment. And so you can generate things like this, which is to say, I can watch this patient breathing in 10 phases, and get a sense, retrospectively, of what they were doing at that point in time. And that's somewhat critical, because you know, if we do the scan again and they breathe differently, the scan's going to look different. And so this is, again, a single snapshot, but it's a summary of a single snapshot of 5 or 10 or 20, 30 seconds. It's not a perfect thing, but it's a heck of a lot more information than we had previously. So what that means for me is that now I have to account for that when I'm planning out where the radiation's going to go. So if we have a GTV, that's that gross target that I really want to make sure it goes away, at expiration and it moves during inspiration, I have to kind of account for both of those positions when I'm doing my radiation planning. And there's alternative ways to deal with that, but the easiest or the most straightforward for many oncologists to think about is that if I never miss the tumor, I never miss the tumor. It's a very straightforward concept. So what we do is we add our usual margins around this, and then we add a PTV, just like I talked about before. These are those uncertainty margins. But I know that at every single point within this blob, the tumor never left there. So as long as I plan for that case, I can't miss, technically, unless the way I acquired the data is wrong, or the patient breathes differently, or there's 100 other uncertainties that we can't deal with when we have this sort of stepwise interval progression between the planning and all the other data. So this leads us to other ways to look at that data. So we can use those external surrogates, but there's actually a ton of information in the images themselves. And when I was at WashU, I was fortunate enough to have a buddy who I played Frisbee with who happened to be a computer vision guy. And we were talking one day while throwing the Frisbee, and he basically asked me, well, why hasn't anyone looked at or why hasn't anyone done this without using the breathing signal? And I was like, I don't know. That seems like a hard thing. So he basically encouraged me to give him a big pile of data, which I was able to do. And what we did was the current methods are 4D reconstruction using the breathing, and we just wanted to go back through and look at the images themselves to see if there was enough data there to play with. And so he actually is a pretty bright guy. He focuses on manifold learning, which is, from what I understand, a low-dimensional ordering of data that's hard for me to understand. But the short and long of it is you need a lot of data in a lot of different positions along the breathing cycle, and you really want the data to only vary by a few things. And for instance, lung cancer is actually kind of useful because it only varies by really breathing or by heart rate. Those are kind of pretty much the only two things that tend to perturb the data. You can add contrast, but we really don't. And so what he was able to do was actually compute the distance metric or the image similarity metric between all the different pictures that I gave him and all the different slices and generate and apply this isomap and do some eigenvalue stuff. There's hard math there. But provided an optimal ordering that assigned similar images to similar parameters, and then using that same kind of sectioning, we were able to reconstruct 3D volumes. So I'm just going to kind of go through this. This is the old way with the standard breathing signal that we would usually use, and then the reordering. Instead, what we did was grabbed those same images, applied the similarity metric to map them to a 1D low-dimensional space, and reorder in the same way, using only the internal data to the scan itself. And so for each couch position, each of those segments, we then get effectively its own isolated parameter space that we can relate only at this point by the fact that they're next to each other, because we knew that they had to be next to each other because we moved the scanner from this slice to this slice and they were adjacent. So the problem is you can see that when we cheated here and labeled these by the actual breathing data, so you can see that sometimes we flip them, sometimes they're just different, they're weighted differently. So we had to do, and I'm going to use this is the only time I'm going to use the word optimization in my entire talk, we had to optimize the interface between each of those slices to kind of mesh them up so they would all stick so we could look at the entire package as an entire package as opposed to each slice as an individual little bit of data. And so I presume we had Manfred, who's one of the graduate students that was working with Robert, spent a lot of time playing with this. But the short and long of it is, eventually, he was able to match this position in this parameter space to this position in this parameter space, kind of reweight everything until it fits, and then it went from this to this. And what this means is that we can then select a given parameter level through the entire data set, and hopefully we would get a volume that made sense, didn't have discontinuities along the edges of the sections, and we could then walk through a breathing cycle the same way we can walk through a 4D CT using the respiratory signal that we get the old-fashioned way, quote-unquote. So this is just an example of how you can get a ton of interesting questions out of a whole bunch of data, but relevant is that we may or may not need this because we're already acquiring the respiratory signal. But there may be some things that we're not acquiring. It may be that heart rate actually was important and we didn't account for that when we acquired the data. Theoretically, with enough oversampling, you can look at any of those other motion parameters simultaneously. So as I said, you need to have enough data in each segment to really do that reconstruction. So if someone's not breathing for one of those sections, you just don't have any sample, and so you can't really do any exploration of that space. There has to be image differences, and you saw probably at the very top of the lung where you're not having a lot of movement, there wasn't a lot of variation between the image similarity metric. There just wasn't a lot of space there because not much is happening. That may not matter, though, because if not much is happening, we don't really care. So as I mentioned, if you have multiple axes you want to look at, multiple cardiac motion or hysteresis, or you want to get sufficient data to really do a very detailed examination, you have to scan for a long time, potentially, which has implications in terms of radiation dose from the CT scanner itself. But the short and long of it is when we did a direct comparison between the old way and the new way, the movies or the generated data sets were actually quite qualitatively similar, and we're working on quantitating that still. then there's more stuff you can do. Once you have these sorts of motion maps, you can generate vector fields of motion, deformation, and then once you have that, you could actually look at a population of patients and say, for the last 30 patients we did scans on, or 27 in this case, what was the average magnitude of the vector of movement for different regions of the lung? How does that affect things? How does that change what our dose is doing to the tumor? And so if we add up that initial radiation dose, combine it with this motion map, and this is a crude approximation, and this is a population model applied to a single patient with a whole bunch of assumptions, but the short and the long of it is, you could do this on a patient-by-patient basis if you had enough computational crunch, and you could convolve or change the dose to what it would, quote-unquote, actually be as it was delivered. And so there's lots of interesting things that we don't know the answers to in this space because we don't actually recalculate each patient's dose based on what their breathing is every single day. But the dose difference can actually be relatively significant. And, you know, 5-10 gray blurred out makes a big deal. And when we looked back and tried to correlate whether or not that dose difference actually made a difference in terms of outcomes, so we tried to correlate the radiation dose to a toxicity that we sometimes see, which is effectively an inflammation of the lung, where the radiation causes a lung reaction that makes people short of breath, and they get sick and can sometimes die from this. When we looked, and this is a very crude approximation, but not accounting for the fact that different people have different radio sensitivities, not accounting for the fact that this was a population average or anything else, it looks like we have a slightly better correlation between the dose delivered and the outcome with the corrected data than we did with the original planned dose. And this, I can almost guarantee, was not perfectly correct. In fact, I'm almost sure it's wrong. But it's very exciting because it would be nice to do this on a more global scale with better data and hopefully with much better doses. So I'm going to just summarize. Breathing is bad in the sense that it moves tumors. It's good in the sense that I don't want it to stop. The 4DCT does allow us to get additional data that we can use to plan, and hopefully down the line we can mix this 4D information with the existing 3D data. We can add in the fact that FTG PET or PET scans are a lung scan and they blur out a lot of the motion of the lung because that data is acquired over time. And we'd like to correct dose distributions to be perfect, ideally, for each patient over the entire time they're treated. And I think those are some problems that are going to take an awful lot of data and a lot of time and a lot of crunch to solve, and hopefully somebody's interested in doing some of that. But down the line, so we planned all this radiation out. We then have to figure out if we're actually hitting the target on a day-to-day basis. So I plan this radiation on day one, and then on day 2, 4, 7, 12, 15, out to 35 days of treatment, we for a long time didn't really check to see how we were doing. We just assumed that nothing changed. And that led us to develop something called Combeam CT, which is effectively, this is a linear accelerator. The big head down here shoots the radiation. This is actually kind of receives it in the sense that it measures some of the radiation coming through. And what the people who built this unit did was they actually set up a standard X-ray unit effectively at an orthogonal angle to the treatment device so you could get some pictures on the same gantry and you could rotate it around. And you know they had some relatively reasonable stats, but if they could circle it around in about 2 minutes, and they can actually generate in a very similar fashion to, sad, movie failure. Talk failure. I don't know what happened. Oh, there we go. I got nothing. So short and long of it is if you rotate this around, you can actually generate a CT scan the same way that you could using a dedicated CT. The only problem is it's a single flat plane image. So what we used to do is this. So this is the original treatment plan. So there's a tumor in here. I've planned out the radiation to hit that area in the middle, kind of not where the little hash marks are. And, you know, once a week or so, we take one of these, which is a standard flat X-ray using usually the treatment beam itself, which is to say high-energy X-rays that have very bad diagnostic properties, which is to say they don't really stop very, very easily. And so we can't really see much of anything. You might see a hint that there's a tumor kind of here, but you really can't get a sense for how good or bad you're lining up your treatment on a day-to-day basis. So using the cone beam unit that's now mounted on the machine, we're going to actually improve that. And I'm going to just skip ahead. Wouldn't you rather have this, where you could see exactly where the tumor is on a day-to-day basis to know what you're treating and if you're in the right spot? And I know I do. So when I'm I'm looking at my images to be sure that I haven't missed the target, I'd much rather would say I haven't missed the target for sure here than look at that other X-ray and say, yeah, maybe. So this is just a quick, hopefully, example of what we do on the treatment machine now. We actually line up the patient, do a cone beam CT scan, and then at the time of the treatment, we actually assess to see if the match for what we planned out is actually what we are going to hit. And if it's not, we do a translational correction. We don't do rotation, we don't do deformation, we just kind of move things around until they're about the right spot. So we know that in some cases there's enough rotation that we're wrong, but this is a heck of a lot better than having the old flat X-rays where we weren't even sure we were on the right half of the chest sometimes because the image quality was so bad. So this is actually a pretty dramatic step forward, but knowing how to correct for rotation or deformation would be even a bigger step forward. And this is what this image-guided radiation process now entails for us, is that we set the patient up, hopefully in the right spot on the table, we image them, check to see if we're hitting the target. If we are, we go ahead and treat. If we're not, we adjust and then re-image to make sure that they're in the right spot. So this is actually a feedback cycle that we can use to actually make sure we're not missing. So I'm just going to give you a quick example clinically of a patient that we treat. This is a kind of de facto patient who had presented with a brain tumor, turned out to be from a lung cancer. And the reason I use this case is that brain tumors are going to be, I think, a focus of some of the next talk, hopefully. But I'm going to not deal with that. I'm going to let Ross take that. But the staging eventually led to the treatment of the chest. And there was no evidence of any lumps or cancer in the lymph nodes. But we still wanted to treat the primary tumor, because if we can get rid of the primary tumor here, and we got rid of the primary tumor here, there's still a chance of curing them. So it's a rare one, but we have cured people before. But unfortunately, this patient, between the time that they were staged originally, and this is their big tumor right next to where the airway comes off on the right side of the chest, and when they just started, they collapsed the lung. And this looks a lot like that very first picture that we saw, where the tumor kind of blends into the collapsed lung, and you can't see where the tumor begins or ends. Fortunately, we had known where the tumor was at the time of the planning, so we used that as our target, basically, and just accounted for this in the setup. And the green here and the purple represent the planning and the day of the treatment, and we overlay them again in a rigid fashion and kind of tweak that registration until we're pretty comfortable. And you can see on this day, the registration led to a little rotational error and a tiny, maybe half a centimeter in terms of translational errors that needed to be corrected. You know, along the way, maybe midway through, we were planning to do a boost coming up real soon. And a boost is where you give a little bit of focused radiation right to where the target is after you've given radiation to the larger area. And surprise, surprise, that area that had collapsed now opened up in response to the treatment. It's actually beginning to respond. The airway opened up. And we can now see that on a day-to-day basis and recognize that. And more importantly, we actually can plan the radiation boost so it's only hitting the target. It's not hitting that collapsed lung anymore. It's not hitting other stuff that we don't want to hit. It's hitting only the thing we care about, which is the tumor. And from then on, we were able to keep treating just that focused area and spare more normal tissue, i.e. the normal lung, which is good. And in fact, this patient was doing great 8 months in this scan. I believe they're out about 12 months now, and there's no sign of any tumor recurrence yet, which is great. So, but we see these sorts of changes over time when we watch with the cone beam, and you can see this tumor shrunk from the beginning of the treatment toward the middle, toward the end. And if we had sufficient resources to figure out what to do with that information, we might be able to actually improve the treatment every step of the way. Right now, we just don't have the ability to deal with that influx of additional change or that additional data. But we know that a lot of patients have those sorts of changes. This is just, I think, 7 or 8 patients that we looked at maybe last year, just had sequential imaging on different days, and we looked at see what the tumor volume was over time. And it always, well, in most patients, went down. But you could imagine that this patient, if we were able to change the type of treatment that we did from the beginning to the end, we might be able to spare quite a bit of tissue. So This is stolen blatantly from a colleague who might be hiding in the audience, but from the NKI. And they're showing basically 4D combing, which is to say, taking all those projections and doing the same sort of sorting that I had shown you before, where they use a signal embedded in the data, they can actually reconstruct the motion of the tumor just from that projection data going around. And in this case, they use 700 projections around 360 degrees. And this was taken from the data that was acquired at the time of checking to see if the treatment was going to the right place. And when you look at multiple days, you can see there's some confounding issues. So not only does kind of the tumor move a little bit around, it actually doesn't stay in the same spot. So you can see that, you know, where we targeted here, the tumor is closer to the chest wall here than it was here, and it's a little bit smaller here than it was here. It's a very complex change over time that, again, we don't really deal with on a day-to-day basis. I mean, this data was presented 3 or 4 years ago, and I would probably argue that there's very few places in the world that even know how to deal with the influx of the data, much less what to do and what to change about our treatment going forward. And so how do we adapt radiation therapy to these changes that we can detect now? There's a whole field that was developed called adaptive radiation planning, but we don't know in most cases what the trigger should be. When we see tumor change, should it be tumor change? Should it be normal tissue change? Should it be changes in functional imaging, like tumor response? What is the cost of that replanning process? So to generate a treatment plan, it takes us maybe 6 or 8 hours of people time. And if we had to do that every single day, we could treat one patient, probably. But since we have to treat, you know, hundreds of patients every day, we need to have basically a computational or automated solution to deal with those changes, deal with the changes to the plans, and deal with ways to get that back out to the machines to be used. So there's, again, just a huge amount of data that has to be dealt with, much less the issues of which parts of the data we want to focus on. Which brings us back to the treatment response assessment. And I showed you the PET scan in general to start with. This is the patient that had lung cancer here and was treated and subsequently failed in a lymph node just above where their cancer was. And these are the sorts of things that make me cringe, because if I'd treated just this area on this functional image, I would never have known that this was there because it was below the detectability of that imaging modality I was using. But we know that functional imaging changes over time, just like the size can change. We can detect changes in the functional response from a PET scan. And when people look at where tumors fail, quite often it's actually that the tumor fails right in the middle of where the tumor started. So we either didn't get enough dose, or it moved and we didn't know it, or any number of complexifying issues in terms of tumor response to radiotherapy. Maybe this patient just had a really mean tumor that didn't respond to radiation, or maybe there wasn't enough blood flow to cause tumor death. There's a lot of issues that we don't understand, but these sorts of issues I really don't prefer. You know, we just didn't treat that area where the cancer ended up. And that's the sort of stuff that we need to be able to try to bring back into our cycle of information. So similarly, we want to bring back data about the way the normal lung responds to radiation. And we can look at functional images of lung itself. So in this case, this group actually did PET scans on patients that had radiation to the lung, but it wasn't for lung cancer. It was for esophageal cancer, which is near the lung, but fortunately not in the lung. And they were able to show that the uptake on the PET scan, or the functional irritation or inflammation of the lung tissue, was correlated with the amount of radiation dose and with the location, and actually was individually predictive. So patients who had a higher early PET response, higher inflammation, went on to develop symptoms more often than those who didn't. So incorporating that functional imaging, kind of overlaying it back over the radiation plan and over the actual imaging dose, is relevant. What maybe even more relevant is figuring out a way to actually correlate the pathology or the actual tumor itself with what we see in the picture. So in this case, we actually have patients who have PET scans before they get a surgery. And in some cases, they've had radiation and chemotherapy beforehand, and then we can monitor how they're doing. And let's say we give a patient 5 weeks of radiation, and we see this result in the PET scan, and we take it out, and there's no tumor. If we do that on enough patients, eventually we're going to know which patients are going to have tumor and which patients aren't. But it really does require us to be able to map this imaging data back onto this pathology specimen to say, this part where the tumor was, corresponded to this part, which we then can map onto the imaging. And that whole registration has a number of tremendously complex problems, including, you know, deformation, you know, fixation, imaging characteristics themselves, as well as all sorts of other related problems that have to do with the treatment response, inflammation of normal tissues, all sorts of stuff. But from my standpoint, if I can look under a microscope and see there's no tumor, that makes me happy. But I'd like to be able to prove that without having to cut the patient open and take the tumor out. So that would be the way we'd want to correlate pathology to validate the imaging methods. And again, there's a bunch of people trying this area, but it's really, really hard. So to kind of summarize the benefits of image guidance for lung cancer, we know that MR and CT can identify the target and the evolved nodes. PET helps us by picking out those nodes or those areas that are critically involved with tumor. 4DCT captures the tumor movement, at least at the time we plan, and we can use cone beam to visualize the tumor during treatment and watch it move or respond or change over time. And that may allow us over time to target more specifically, reduce those margins of uncertainty, to really focus in on where the tumor is and avoid normal tissue, which would subsequently allow us to increase the dose that I can deliver to that target safely so I can get rid of that tumor more often. And then maybe, as a part of that, use bigger doses per fraction so I can do it in less time. So the patient doesn't have to be there for 7 weeks in some cases. All of which will hopefully equal better local control. And so really what we want to have is that full understanding of the dynamic nature of the tumor and of the treatment itself incorporated into our tools. So we should really have, all our plan systems should be physiologic. They should have 4D motion. They should have 5D motion. They should be able to incorporate multiple types of imaging over time, multiple modes of imaging over time, and kind of group that all into some way that I can actually look at it and not cry. So ideally, there's going to be a ton of demand for this going forward, because that's really going to be the way we're going to individualize patient care and hopefully cure more people. But there's going to be a lot of requirements to generate novel methods to do things like deformable tissue registration to imaging and similar approaches with imaging in general. So just to bring it kind of all to a close, the lung cancer is bad. It is the most deadly thing that I know of in the oncologic world right now. Treatment of lung cancer with radiation utilizes all of the imaging modalities that I've mentioned. It uses target motion assessment, at least at big institutions that can afford to do it. And we do monitor all our patients that are getting radical cured of lung cancer daily to make sure that we're hitting the target. And we also monitor longitudinally to make sure that we're not missing and we're using imaging to track the tumor. But all of these can benefit from improved computational methods, and making imaging a more fundamental, integral part of our treatment would be a better thing. So that's really all I have. This is that beautiful magic place where all that imaging comes together in one big platform. So be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Let's start doing some type of questions while we on this week.
Yeah.
When you say that lung cancer is the most deadly lung cancer in the world, what are the parameters of that statement? Because pancreatic cancer, to my understanding, if you have pancreatic cancer, you're going to think basically the treatment you could apply, if you have pancreatic cancer, you will die.
Yeah.
Cancer is survivable.
Yes and no. When I say most deadly, I mean most quantity of death, not the individual lethality of the disease. You're correct. There are cancers that, if you get them, are much more likely to kill you than lung cancer, i.e. 95% or 99% likely to kill you, but the chance of you getting it is extremely rare.